Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case. Hello, I'm Linda. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Stephanie, Teresa, Nicola, Pat, and Heather.
Hello.
Hi.
And Wilfie, our little spaniel, adorable Write Club mascot. Can Wilfie say hello?
No, he's fast asleep.
He's not saying anything.
Wilfie is a wonderful little friend over here. He never talks during our podcast. So.
He's a Cocker Spaniel, by the way.
Oh, he's a black and beautiful Cocker Spaniel. And Stephanie owns him, or he owns Steph.
Yeah, he does own him.
Some of us like to share him sometimes.
Yeah, we do. And
he's a great house guest.
We have to put him online, a picture, so you can see him on our Write Club, the podcast group.
I'll do that.
Yes, yeah. Okay. This week, we're going to have Stephanie's going to read from her work in progress. And Pat's going to talk about French phrases. We're going to interview two travel writers who blog. They've started it for love, but one of them has made it a full-time career. Teresa and Naomi Kruger will share what's on their bedside tables. But first, Nicola is going to ask us to...
name the novel. Yeah, and I think I've got a good one here. I think I've kept the theme.
Is it science fiction?
No. not that kind of travel. It's the author said about this book, it's the only book I have written for fun. And it's about Henry, who's an uncharming retired bank manager, and he meets an eccentric aunt at his mother's funeral, and who tells him that his mother was not truly his mother and his father has been dead for 40 years.
Oh, no, I bet it's...
You got it already, haven't you?
I can't remember what it's called. I know the author, but I can't remember the name.
We've got it between us, okay. Yeah, I think.
Okay, clue two?
Might know.
Yes.
Okay, he travels first with her to Brighton, then Paris to Istanbul on the Orient Express... As the journey unfolds, so do the stories of the aunt, painting a picture of a woman for whom love has been the defining feature of her life.
Mm. I have no idea.
Right. Okay. I think so.
Okay. As the travels progress, it becomes clear to Henry that the woman he had been raised to believe was his mother was in fact his aunt, and his real mother is Augusta, and her reconnection with him at her sister's funeral is her way of getting in touch with her son.
No idea, but it sounds interesting.
Well, shall I do the title and you do the author? Oh, I think. Is it Travels with My Aunt?
Yes, it is.
Oh. Is it Graham Greene?
Yes, it is.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And yeah. I actually read this. I've got a real embarrassing admission here. I actually read this and thought it was a real-life account of Graham Greene travelling with his aunt.
Mm.
It's because it was so vivid.
Mm. Yeah. I've never read it, I must admit.
I've never read it either.
I think so. I might have heard it on the radio.
I'm embarrassed to admit that, but I had to tell the truth.
Don't worry.
Well, thank you, Nicola. That really does sound very interesting. I like things like that where...
There's a denouement at the end.
Yeah, there is. Yes, yes. And now we're going to hear from Steph, who's going to read to us from her work in progress. You want to set it up, Steph?
Is that how it goes?
Yeah. This is... Grace has been admitted to hospital and has spent the first day and night in hospital. And so this is quite early on in the story. And this is after breakfast. The sister stood in the middle of the ward and said, "Coats on, ladies, and to the airing court." And they all troop outside. She remembered little else about that first night and morning. But later, in the airing court, Grace became aware of 40 or more women around her. A couple, like Grace, sat alone on wooden benches, watchful. A few were knitting. Many sat reading books or periodicals. Some just stared into the distance, deep in thought. One marched around the path which ran between the flower beds and the central lawn, as if on an urgent errand. Grace watched her stop to pick at the bark of a birch tree, which came away in satisfying strips, before sniffing at the crisp air and striding on. There were two older ladies in wheelchairs. One smiled easily when she met other eyes, but her companion was slumped, head lolling, drowsy and dribbling. Many of the others strolled arm in arm or stood in small groups, gossiping, chattering. Some were obviously simpletons, but apart from the high brick wall which enclosed them and the lack of children at their feet, most of them could have been workaday women enjoying a brief sojourn in any park in England, Grace mused. Grace turned to the sound of an uproarious laugh. About 3 yards away, a flaxen-haired woman, who Grace judged to be in her early 30s, sat on a wooden park bench rolling small threads of tobacco into a cigarette paper, rocking with amusement, while a younger girl with short, conker-dark hair was beside her, whispering close to her ear. Grace watched as they erupted with amusement again. "Oh, Ed, you are a one!" the blonde shrieked, wiping the back of her hand across an eye and gasping for breath. "My Charlie would have a purple fit if he knew I was even listening." Ed's face lit up. She was obviously delighted by the scolding. "What your Charlie doesn't see, he can't grieve over. Think of it as a compensation for your incarceration. Be back in a jiffy, just off to get a light for this." The blonde waggled her thin cigarette, her hips rolling as she crossed the grass. Grace watched Ed's eyes follow her friend until she was out of sight, then cast a languid look round, pushing her hands into the pockets of her slacks. Grace averted her eyes an instant too late and studied her fingernails, anticipating a rebuke. "Hello there, you're new, aren't you?" said a well-spoken voice. Grace blinked up and met the striking hazel eyes of the willowy girl. Her hair was cut close to her head, but still had a wave. The young woman thrust out a hand. "I'm only here temporarily." Grace let the words tumble from her mouth and was half surprised to hear they came out in the right order. Ed shrugged and flung herself onto the bench next to Grace, pulled out a small packet of cigarette papers and started to roll a cigarette. Grace caught a slight movement from the doorway to the ward through which Peggy had disappeared. She peeped from beneath her eyebrows. Sister Burton was watching. What was she looking for? Grace gave herself a little shake and forced her lips into a watery smile as she addressed Ed. "What I meant was, I'm Grace and I'm pleased to meet you. I'm here for observation."
Yeah, I thought that was very well observed. There were some nice little details when Grace averted her eyes an instant too late. I thought that was very well observed, and with a bit about letting the words tumble from her mouth. I thought that was very insightful of the way that she's feeling that she may not even be able to speak properly. She's kind of so, you know, I found very little to criticise in the writing. I'm surprised that Grace is as calm and accepting as she is. She seems to take it all in with a very cool eye, and I'm not sure if that's intentional. There are, what else did I have? So the first paragraph I thought was great. You have Grace musing as she observes these people. And I thought, she's a bit relaxed for her situation, maybe. I don't know
if you like the phrase. I think when you read it, it didn't sound like it was needed at the end of that paragraph.
Right.
Yes.
I see what you're
saying.
So maybe
that would take that feeling away as well.
Right. It changes the tone.
Again, just little things. Ed's face lit up, and I just thought, well, one, it's a bit of a cliche, and you're telling us she was obviously delighted.
Yep.
So maybe you could do without that, and
absolutely.
It's okay just to tell us there.
Yeah.
When Ed speaks to Grace, you say she was well spoken, but we've already heard her speak.
Yes.
So
yes.
I thought that it wasn't quite right.
Yeah. It made me feel like it might be a different character. I got confused about who was who there at that point because of that.
And similarly, I think the door to the ward through which Peggy had disappeared, you haven't given Peggy a name before. So we're left to suppose it's the woman who's gone looking
that's
for a
true.
Light. I think there were just little things that are a little bit confusing.
Yep.
On that same theme, you'd mentioned that Ed's hair, and then you mentioned it again. And there was just that sort of fraction of a second where you thought,
is this someone new?
Is it somebody different?
It is difficult, isn't it? Because Grace doesn't know these people's names. Yeah, right. She knows Ed because the other woman uses the name.
Yeah. Yeah.
So writing it is quite difficult, isn't it? You've got to identify them physically by the hair or their willowy figure or whatever. But
I thought you did a really good job of showing Ed's personality and character.
Yes.
She's a quite a masculine looking, but elegant but masculine in a sort of androgynous kind of way.
Very pleased.
She didn't tell me she was androgynous. She showed me.
I'm pleased about that because that will turn out to be quite an important part of the story.
Right.
The way she threw her Was that included in the bit?
No, flung herself onto the bench.
Yes, exactly.
And pushing the hands into the pockets.
It's confidence, isn't it, as well? That you know, but
with a sort of masculine edge.
But good. I'm very, very pleased that's come across.
Didn't like peeked out from under the eyebrows. I sat there for a little while. Well, no, peeked out from under eyelashes would have worked. But the eyebrows, how do you peep out from under your eyebrows? I spent quite a lot of time peeping out.
You can't see Nicola's face as she tries to do this, but I'm going to enter for next year's Cumbria Gurning competition.
I'm feeling quite Neanderthal with my eyebrows.
Nothing wrong with being Neanderthal.
You can't say Nicola doesn't do her research.
But I could peep out under my eyelashes if I had more of them.
Okay.
What's Ed's name?
Edna. It's actually Gertrude Edna Marguerite Butterick Ford.
Oh.
But that won't come out just yet. It comes out a little bit later on in this scene.
Okay. Right.
And I love the way, again, you know, you drew her so well. Mm-hmm. But I love the way she's obviously, you know, what you're wondering, what's she in there for? Mm. You know, and that gives you the setup that some people are in there for other reasons than being obviously simpletons.
Right. Well, I think you get that as well from the opening couple of paragraphs, the description and the fact that all these women could be perfectly normal.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And I like that phrase where you said, except for no children running around their feet. That was wonderful. Yeah. And also, when you talked about she's pulling the bark off the birch tree, which came away in satisfying strips.
Yes.
I love that. You know,
the
I
OCD
love that.
Among us got that.
Well, I feel very satisfied when I can peel my nail polish and But I really feel for Grace because she is in such a horrible dilemma. And she's so, to me, I just think of her as a sweet, sweet, from what you've read to us before. Seems to me to be a sweet person and just horribly misunderstood in this hospital. They don't give her a chance to express herself that well. And when she said, I'm only here temporarily, I thought, well, that
gives you
so
a
much,
pang,
so
it?
Much. Yeah, I just wrote, bless her.
Yeah.
Well, at the moment, she is only here temporarily.
Right.
This is from quite early. She's been taken in for a week's observation.
Right.
This is her first full day in the hospital. Mm.
But then when she corrects herself, what I meant was, I'm Grace, and I'm here for observation. Mm. How sweet. I think she felt maybe the first was a little too harsh or not friendly.
Yeah.
Well, I think she's just realised... What I hope she just realised is that she's being watched.
Yes.
She's there for observation.
Oh, right.
Sister Burton's watching her.
Right.
And throughout
this
scene, there'll be references to Sister Burton watching.
Right.
Because she is there for observation, they are observing her, they are making notes on her behaviour.
That's what came across to me was that when she realised she was being watched, she tried to be very sort of.
Polite.
Gave herself a little shake and smiled a watery smile too.
And I got the feeling that was the first time she realised she was being watched.
Well, that's what they used to do with people is they would make an urgency order.
Mm-hmm.
And an urgency order was only for 7 days.
Mm. Uh-huh.
And so within 7 days, the hospital had to make a diagnosis to commit somebody. And she was admitted under an urgency order. Mm-hmm. So they've got 7 days to decide whether or not she's fit to leave.
Mm-hmm. And people were in there for all sorts of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There was something called moral insanity. Yeah. Mm. You had a baby out of wedlock, you'd be declared morally insane.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah.
If you were epileptic. For years and years and years.
Yeah.
And if you were epileptic...
You were in for life, huh?
Well, epilepsy was considered a form of insanity.
I looked after a gentleman who'd been admitted to a mental hospital because he stole a bicycle.
Oh, really?
And he came out and he was over 65 and he'd been in for years and years and years and years. And he was discharged into the community because that was how things were moving.
Mm-hmm.
And he had no idea how to live.
That is so,
but
so
all
sad.
He did was steal a bicycle.
Yeah. That would have been moral insanity.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. It's so sad, the things that have happened to these people. What was the book? What was the book? Something
One
about,
Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
No, yeah, Bedlam, right. I think it was.
Bedlam. Yeah.
Bedlam.
That was an earlier period. That was the late 1800s, 19th century. Yeah.
But it absolutely was horrifying what happened to the people.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a book by Anna Hope called Ballroom, and that's taken from the First World War era, so early in the 20th century. And there, the protagonist has had a bit of a temper tantrum at work.
Mm-hmm.
She was angry about something at work. And she was working in a mill and she threw something and it broke a window. She ended up in a mental hospital, in an asylum.
Yeah.
But actually, if you look at old historical records, people were often poor people and often women.
Right.
You know, a woman that had a temper or a foul mouth or was just outspoken
might
be considered mentally unstable in a way that it wouldn't have applied to a man.
Mm. Right.
So, woe betide you if you didn't
and
behave
yourself.
And
anyone who's watched Poldark recently knows that you could be put in the 17th, 18th century, you could be put in a mental asylum for just refusing to have sex with your husband.
Really?
Yeah. If you weren't fulfilling your marital obligations, you could be put in a mental asylum.
Oh,
I know, don't get us started. We'll get really cross.
Thank you very, very... Sorry.
Stop.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your feedback. It's great.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Steph. Next up, Pat is going to tell us about some commonly used French phrases. Right, Pat?
Mm. Yeah, I was doing my little bit of preparation, and we always refer to this segment as the amuse-bouche. You know, this sort of little taster thing that just slots in between the two main features. And it started me thinking about all those other French expressions that we use in English without even really thinking about it. And I just thought, and I just came up with it, you know, bon voyage, tête-à-tête, déjà vu, like that. I thought, what others are there? And I bet, you know, if I asked you, you could all sort of throw half a dozen or so.
Fait accompli.
Pied-à-terre.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, without even thinking about it. But in fact, there are actually hundreds, if not thousands, of them. And when I sort of started looking into it, there were just lists and lists and lists. And I thought, oh, my word. And most of them I knew.
Mm-hmm.
But until you actually sort of sit down and think about it, you don't even know you know them. But apparently, because of our history with the French language, it's estimated that English speakers who've never even studied French already know 15,000 French words.
Good Lord, really?
Good Lord.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, I mean, most people will probably realise that when William the Conqueror invaded from Normandy, from France, he brought French language with him.
Mm.
And the French language became the language of the courts, administration, literature, and so on, for about 300 years or so, while English was, I think, was demoted to humble everyday uses and became the language of peasants and the uneducated. Yeah. There are those who would say it still is, but there you go.
No, that's American.
Oh,
get one in there.
Have to talk to you.
But so during the Norman occupation, about 10,000 French words were incorporated into English. And I think now we have words that are basically French words without us even realising. But it's those little phrases that double entendre, pièce de résistance, things like that, that we use without even considering them. Though, interestingly, those two, along with a number of others, in lieu of, maître d', aren't used in French.
They are.
No, they might be derived from the French. Sometimes it's the grammar as well. It's the way it's sort of been, the ending has been changed, or the actual grammatical construction is a little bit different. But you think about literature, we've got, you know, the words that we use during our everyday discussions of something. Dénouement. You can't talk about plotting without mentioning dénouement. We're all hoping to produce a tour de force.
That's what we all. It'd be nice.
We all consider ourselves perhaps to be a bit of a raconteur.
Especially after several rosés.
There you go. But and we're all trying to avoid making a bit of a faux pas, in our in our recordings. So it's just there, and it sort of intrigued me.
And what have we given them back? Le weekend.
Le binge drinking.
Really? Le binge
drinking. We rock.
Le McDonald's.
What about parlez-vous français? I probably am not.
Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?
Oh, yeah.
That's what.
Parlez-vous anglais is, do you speak English?
English.
Yeah. What's the one about French? Parlez-vous
français.
Yeah, do you speak French?
And then how about concierge?
Yes.
I'm busy learning how to say Gaelic in Greek at the moment. Do you speak Greek? Do you speak English? Do you speak French?
Ah, okay.
But don't ask me to do it because I can't remember.
Gallica.
Gallica. That's it.
Gallica.
I like mot d'escalier. Is that the correct term? When you think of a witty riposte when it's just too late, you know, the thing you would have said if you...
Oh,
yeah,
I don't know.
I think it's... I might have got that wrong. I think it's mot d'escalier on the stairs, you can think of it.
Oh, okay.
Well.
And what about modus operandi?
Latin.
Modus operandi.
Latin. Oh, it's
as magnum opus.
Yeah.
Well, darn. I failed that test.
So you're not as au fait with the French language.
Oh, really?
Well, I think for the next few episodes we'll be laughing at every French expression we come up with.
I decided I couldn't find any sort of like real explanation of why we're still using all these phrases, but I think it comes down to, maybe it goes back to the Grand Tour that people made in the 17th, 18th centuries, and it was a way of sort of establishing that, you know, you had a certain position in society by dropping these little phrases.
You were cut above.
Was a certain amount of snobbery in it, but sometimes...
Adds an air of sophistication as well.
Yeah, a foreign phrase or word can remain in the English language because it's apt and there isn't an English equivalent.
That's right.
I can't think of a good example now that I've said that, but like concierge, it's kind of a French thing. We don't really have that.
It would be clumsy to, put it into
some bloke
English.
Who stands at a desk at the front of the hotel and sorts out your every need.
But in apartment blocks in Paris, there's a concierge.
Oh, okay.
You know, he's like the caretaker janitor, or he or she, I should say. But that they still have that in Paris. If you rent an apartment, there's usually a concierge.
Yeah,
it's responsible.
And you have them in New York, those fancy apartment buildings.
Oh, yes,
they always have a concierge.
Well, yes, they have.
Increasingly, I think in the UK now there seem to be a lot more apartment building and houses, and a lot of the sort of higher rent ones do have concierges as well.
The mobile phone companies talk about concierge services.
Yeah,
It's become a kind of a way of, it's almost become an adjective for some kind of special personal service.
Personal service. That's it. What about foods? I'm sorry, foods. There are so many.
Lots of phrases have come to us, I think, through like culinary terms.
Haute cuisine, cordon bleu.
Only this morning,
café au lait.
I stopped at the Greek bakery to buy a pain au chocolat.
There you go. That's international.
I was very hungry.
But I think as I was saying, people use it to add this air of sophistication. Mm-hmm. And who can forget Del Boy? Mange too, Rodney. Yeah. I'll explain that to Linda later.
We keep threatening to have theme evenings in the winter for Linda, don't we? So that we can introduce her to the joys of
right.
Carry On.
Yeah, I've got Carry On ready.
We've got the Carry On.
So we have more.
Only Fools and Horses.
Earlier this week, we interviewed Monica Stunt, the founder and editor of the Travel Hack, which she calls the Stylish Adventures blog. We will follow that with another interview, another travel writer, with Jackie Smith, has a blog called Travel and Write. But let's go to Monica's interview.
Today, we're joined by Monica Stott, a.k.a. the Travel Hack, who's been blogging now for 9 years and is one of the top UK travel bloggers. She's voted number 2 by Yahoo Travel and has been in the top 10 UK bloggers for at least 5 years. So we're very lucky to have her. So hi, Monica.
Hi. Hi, thank you for having me on the podcast.
Can you tell me, Monica, how did you first get into travel blogging?
So, yeah, I started about 9 years ago now. And the reason I started was because at the time I wanted to be a journalist. So I just finished uni and I went and did some work experience with my local newspaper, which was kind of the place where I imagined I'd end up working. So I did a summer of work experience with them, and they had a blog at the time on their website, which kind of featured local people. And there was one, I think there was like a local teacher did a blog. There was a local councillor. There was a local lollipop lady. There was a local lady who'd actually moved to Australia, and it was kind of her journey in Australia. And then I wrote a blog, and I was kind of the local girl who went traveling. And that's how it all started. At that time, I didn't really know what a blog was. But I just, in my head, I saw that I was getting my work published every single week on my local newspaper. And yeah, I was just really pleased with it. So that's how I started out. And I just fell in love with it. I loved being able to share my stories. And then I started getting a bit more into social media, mostly Twitter at that point. So this was 2009. And I met this whole community of travelers, backpackers, you know, people the same age as me, doing the same things as me. And it was just really nice to have this whole community of people all around the world. And these people now are some of my best friends today. So that's kind of what kept me motivated to keep going. And then when I came home from a 2-year backpacking trip, so I went through Southeast Asia and Australia, I then studied journalism and I carried on blogging and probably taking it a bit more seriously because I saw my blog as a portfolio really to get freelance work, freelance journalism kind of work. I didn't really imagine that my blog would turn into my job. I saw it more as a portfolio to find a job.
And so what do you think the reader gets from reading your blog?
I try and have as much valuable information and valuable travel tips in there as I possibly can, but also write it in a kind of relatable, friendly sort of way. So I hope it kind of comes somewhere between a journal and a travel guide. So it's a little bit more entertaining than a travel guide, but probably slightly less personal than a journal. So yeah, I hope that they get inspiration to travel new places and ideas to go to different places, but genuine travel advice that's going to make their traveling easier and generally, yeah, just make travel more easy for people and hopefully learn from my mistakes.
Yeah. I know you're currently very interested in the work-life balance. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it's something that I'm really interested in. I think coming from a family as well where my parents worked very hard and worked very long hours and kind of got to a point where you think, well, what's the point? What's the point in working all these hours? And yeah, having plenty of money, but not really having any time or quality of life or time to really enjoy your life and your family and things. So now for me, growing up, I've seen that working all the hours doesn't make you happy and having more of a work-life balance is more important to me. So it's nice being a blogger as well because most of my income is passive income, which means work I might have done years ago is still generating a small income for me. So I can take quite a lot of time off without worrying about having to earn money because the hours I put in years ago are what generate the income for me now. So myself and my partner, Sam, we've basically both worked part-time. So we both work 3 days a week. I actually do 3 mornings a week. He does 3 full days a week. And then we spend the rest of the time just having fun, really, and having 4-day weekends. And a lot of people work really hard and prepare for retirement, whereas we're kind of working a moderate amount and we'll probably do this all the way through.
That's absolutely brilliant, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And I'm sure you get all the time people saying, oh, you're so lucky, you're so lucky. But you've put the work in to achieve this.
Yeah, exactly. And I do feel that I'm lucky, but I mean, you find the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I think kind of being brave as well. I think a lot of people, because we're so familiar with the whole work really, really hard to climb the career ladder, get a better job, buy a bigger house, all that kind of stuff. And to break away from that is a bit scary, I suppose.
I just really wanted to ask you about your family, because I know you're part of the work-life balance is because you now have children.
Yeah, definitely. So we have 2 little boys, George and Joseph. And yeah, I think it's just really lovely to be able to spend more time with them, but not just for me as a mother, but for Sam as the father, because so many of our friends, the dads don't really see their kids that much during the week, especially because, yeah, you know, they get home at 6 o'clock, the kids are getting ready for bed, they put them to bed, and that's kind of it. And I think it's really nice for Sam, but also nice for me that I don't have to be like the main parent. We genuinely are 50-50 on the parenting, and that's really nice. And yeah, just being there with them growing up, and I know it won't be that long before they're too cool, they won't want to hang out with us, so we're just kind of making the most of it while they're still young.
Yeah,
and things might change as they get older. I suppose when they're both in full-time school, we might change things up a little bit.
One thing I'm personally curious about is the relationship between your online persona and the real life Monica. Are they the same person?
Yeah, I really 100% think I don't really change that much for online. I don't think I've really got the energy to pretend to be someone else online and be someone else in my home life. I think the only thing I kind of hold back on is if there's something happening that I'm not really sure about at the time, I don't tend to talk about it until I feel sure about it. So things like when I first had George, who's my eldest son, I didn't blog about motherhood that much. Whereas now that he's not a baby anymore and I got through that phase and did that, I feel like somebody, say if I wrote something and someone said, oh, you shouldn't do that, I could turn around and say, well, I did it and it worked, so it's fine.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like I'm in a position where it would offend me if somebody said something bad about that. So yeah, I tend to wait until I feel comfortable with everything that I'm doing before I'll talk about it online. But yeah, no, I feel like I'm totally myself online. And I suppose that's part of the thing of successful bloggers. I think you do get a lot of their personality. Right. And if you don't feel a blogger's personality, I don't feel like you can connect with them in the same way. So I think you've kind of got to be yourself. You've got to give it your all. But I suppose I'm very much surrounded by it, so it does feel quite natural to me. A lot of the time as well, one thing I do is I don't share a lot in real time. Quite a lot of the things I'm sharing will appear like they're in real time, but they're actually a week later or so. So I'm not one of those people who will be like having a lovely time, you know, maybe swimming in the swimming pool with my kids, and I'll be like, oh, stop, I need to take a picture of this and I need to put it on Twitter. I don't do that. I'll take a picture at the time, but I don't upload anything live. Because I'm busy. So yeah. I don't want to kind of like interrupt moments just for Twitter. I'll upload it a week later when I'm at home and I've got nothing better to do and I'm sat in my office. And then when people respond, I can tweet them back and I can talk to them and start a conversation with them without, you know, having to worry about my kids running off in a swimming pool.
So now you've got a whole new group of followers, people who want to travel with children rather than backpacking. So your job's growing with you, isn't it? And growing with your...
Yeah, it's really nice how I've gone from the real budget backpacking at 21 to more like people in early stage of their career, probably not got much time, not got much money. And then a little bit later when probably got a little bit more money, but still no time. And now in this kind of phase, yeah, with young children, I think a lot of my audience are at that phase where they're sort of thinking about having children. So it's more about inspiring people and showing people that you can still travel with them and trying to show them what it is like. So it's really nice, actually. I get a lot of messages from people saying, you know, it's really nice to know that you're still doing this with your kids.
Nicola has given me some questions about the business and financial side of blogging. So the first thing she asks is, how long did it take you before you were making a full-time living from your blog?
It took me 6 years. But it was a different time, because when I first started, you couldn't make a living from blogging. So I didn't kind of launch into it thinking I can make money from this, because I couldn't. I think I'd been blogging for about 4 years before I earned anything. Mm-hmm. And I think it was around about that time when it was actually possible to earn anything. So yeah, it took me 6 years, but I think it would be different if you started from scratch now, knowing that there's possibilities out there and knowing that brands would want to work with you. But yeah, it's definitely not an overnight success kind of thing. And I think that's why it's quite nice as well. People who started blogging, when I started blogging, we did it for the love of it and just for the passion and just because we enjoyed doing it. And it kind of comes from a different place when you start doing something just because you love it, not because you think you might earn money from it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Would you say the majority of your income comes from on-site advertising or something else?
No, it comes from something else. So on-site advertising is a really important one for me, because the advertising that I have on my blog is basically the amount that I need to like cover all kind of expenses. Then that means that when kind of different campaigns and different opportunities come along, if it doesn't feel right and it's not a very good fit, or if it's not a brand I want to work with, I can turn it down because I know that I'm still getting my income through the advertising. So then the majority of my income actually comes from brand work. So when I work with a brand, so say if I went to Japan, it might be like the Japanese Tourism Board would be paying me a fee to be there and to create a certain amount of content. So that's the kind of branded work I mean. And it can really be any kind of brand. It's not just things like tourism boards. It'll be airlines and hotels, but it can also be things like clothing brands.
I noticed you worked with a luggage company to design a travel hack luggage, which actually I looked at and I thought, wow, I could do with one of those.
It's actually really, really good. I'm so happy with it. So yeah, so I've designed a suitcase. That's one where so for that kind of work, it's kind of like a flat fee for designing it and then a small percentage of sales. So income comes in loads and loads of different ways. So yeah, there's the advertising, there's the affiliate income, where for example, if I recommended a hotel and somebody booked that hotel, I would earn a small percentage of that sale. And then the brand work, things like products, suitcase. I also run an online course. So that's a small side to the income as well. But I think blogging, because it changes so quickly, well, the way people were earning money through blogging, say 6-7 years ago, is very different to how people earn money now. So I think bloggers are quite conscious of that and are keen to have like multiple income streams. Just in case you lose one, there's always a backup option. So it's really good to kind of have your fingers in lots of different pies and know that if one fails, you've still got your backups. Mm.
So although you're living the dream, it is a little bit precarious.
Yeah. I do have some months where I think, oh God, what's going on this month? But it's been about 5 years now and it's still going well. So I think as long as I try and stay ahead of the curve and aware of what things are doing, and I think it's really important to keep track of kind of where the money's coming from, because it'd be quite easy just to sit back and just sort of like let the money drip in without thinking about where it's coming from, because it can change quite quickly. And
that's the same with any business.
Yeah.
You have to be looking ahead and understanding where you're spending money, where you're making money, what's your most profitable lines, etc. So yeah. That's having a business head on your shoulders. But, you know, if you can make a living from doing something that you'd be doing for fun anyway.
Yeah, I found it was when I started having about 100,000 monthly page views, that's when my income really changed.
So what next? What does the future hold, do you think?
Oh gosh, that's the big question, isn't it? I change my mind every day. But I'm kind of trying to focus on more weekend break destinations. I don't feel like it's been massively done, and I think that's just the gap in the market, because that's generally what most people do. Mm-hmm. Most people take short holidays, and yeah, they might take one or two massive holidays a year, but generally most people are taking weekend breaks. So yeah, I really want to focus on budget, affordable weekend break. It's something that I started doing last year called the £200 Weekender, and it's about taking a weekend break for £200. And so I want to do lots of those, which is quite fun for me as well. It's just fun to book a cheap last minute flight and just go off and see what I can do with £200. I think I'm going to be pushing my e-course a lot more as well, because I feel like blogging as a career is something that's much more viable and more people want to do it. But there isn't a lot of information out there about how to actually turn a blog into a business. There's lots of information about how to set up a blog, how to write well, how to take photos, how to make videos, but not a lot of information about how to actually talk to brands and prove to brands that you should be paid for the work you're doing.
You said you have to write well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think perhaps sometimes we forget that blogging is basically about writing, and writing well, writing in a way that engages people and makes them feel that you're talking to them particularly, yeah, and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I think everyone has different styles, but personally I find in blogging that when it feels like it's a human talking to a human, that's what works well. And it's not a style that everybody can do. I come from like a copywriting kind of background. That was my first kind of way into work. I was doing copywriting, which is very formal, and it was quite a change to go from this formal, formulaic, factual kind of writing into something a bit more friendly and informal. But yeah, it is overlooked that you have to be able to write, and I don't think it's until you read bad writing that you realise how good writing is. Yeah. And you read something that's bad and you think, oh God, how did anyone publish this?
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. I think it is quite a lot of work, but if when people stick with it and continue to post like twice a week, say for 2 years, you're there then. Mm. And you've made it. But I think it's just getting to that point. You know, most people don't do it for the money, but when you do start earning money, that's a really good motivator to keep you going. And yeah, when opportunities come in, it keeps you motivated.
Thanks very much, Monica. It's been lovely.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
Very interesting. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you.
Good.
Well, I've read her blog, and I can tell you she's a very good writer.
And very astute commercially, I think, as well. Yeah. She's really got her head screwed on, knows what she's doing with the commercial side of things.
Right.
And I mean, I would reiterate what I said during the interview. It does look like an easy way to make a living, but it's a lot of hard work to get to that point, and you've got to be a good writer, good businesswoman as well.
Well, she said it took 6 years, right?
I was just going to say, I'm very patient.
Yes.
You know, to do it for that long without anything coming in.
Yeah. I think, you know, the critical mass that's required. I mean, I do have a friend who's a big blogger in the health space, and she told me she took herself off to Mexico for a year, and she didn't go out, she didn't see anyone, she just wrote and the critical mass you need to get noticed by the search engines like that is phenomenal. So but as she says, you know, the hard work's done now, and she's making a nice living.
Very interesting.
Well, I want to ask you, are the search engines considered artificial intelligence?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes,
they do it all on their own.
Well, no, they're programmed by people, but they're given instructions. And, and in fact, blogging is one of the things was hit very hard in 2006. There was an algorithm change, and a lot of people who were depending on advertising revenue from their blogs absolutely had their income cut off at the knees. But that was because their blogs were rubbish. They were spinning articles, and they were putting absolute junk on these sites. And because it was new content, the search engines were indexing them, but it was a nonsense to anyone who tried to read them. So the only people who survived that scything of blogs were people who were actually generating genuine content that had value to people.
Interesting.
It's interesting to think, though, because it is a relatively new development. Mm-hmm. Like you said, Monica sort of herself said it took about 6 years or so, but now in today's climate it would be much quicker for somebody.
That's what she's
saying. But then you look ahead and you think, where will it go?
Yeah,
yeah, right.
And how long
Well, it's very interesting because bloggers were traditionally people who wrote on a passion. And then there were internet marketers, which is the camp I sat in, who knew how to do the commercial bits of it and drive traffic to certain sites that were selling things. And it took a long time for the bloggers to realise that it wasn't a bad thing to earn commercially from your blog. And in fact, she talked about that. And, and I really like the way she said how she only takes... She makes sure that her expenses are covered by the advertising revenue from Google, but she then only takes on special projects if they're in line with her brand. And that was a ethical hurdle that a lot of bloggers had to get over in their minds, that taking money from people was not a bad thing as long as you chose the projects carefully.
Well, that was very interesting. Monica gave us a lot of information about how she's doing it and how her money comes in now from a variety of sources. So now we're going to hear from Jackie Smith of Travel and Write. That's Travel in Write, a blog which she's been doing for years now for love. She and her husband, Joel, they call themselves the Scout and the Scribe. He finds good travel deals. And she writes the blog, and she takes the photographs, which are really beautiful. They've traveled to some wonderful places, and I think you'll find them interesting. But let's go to the interview now. But first, I should say, you may hear some background noise. The day was hot, and the windows were open, but the wind was blowing, and there's a bit of wind sound and now and then a traffic sound in the background. But I think you can hear Jackie perfectly well. Let's go to the interview.
Today we're delighted to be talking to travel blogger Jackie Smith. Jackie is an expat American living in Greece. She's had a former career as a journalist, and she now spends her time on her blog, Travel and Write. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Good morning. Morning. Palomera.
So tell me, Jackie... Why did you start your travel blog?
It was twofold. I've been doing this now since 2009, and it was a twofold reason. The first was to have an easy way to stay in touch with family and friends when we traveled. The other was because as a freelance writer, we found that editors like your following. The more you can bring to a story than the story, the better. So I needed to have an audience, so I began blogging and tweeting and Facebooking and doing all the social media outlets that freelance writers need to have to convince editors that they're worth beyond just the writing, having associations with.
Okay, so it's partly to have that profile on the internet to support your other work as a freelance writer. Okay.
Where did the initial idea come from?
Travel and Write just came to be because we found many friends asking us for advice on how we found the deals and how we selected our destinations. And they kept saying, you were traveling right. How do we do it?
Yeah.
And because I write and we travel, thus the name Travel and Write came to be as a play on words between traveling right and traveling and writing.
Yeah.
So do you have a favorite place that you've visited?
Oh, we've had several favorite places that we visited. Obviously, Greece, because we ended up moving here. We kept coming back to Greece. I think one of our reasons for being in Greece, though, is it's a great launch pad for travel on this side of the pond, as we call it.
Yeah.
Our favorite lately has been an easy destination from here is Egypt. So we go to Cairo. We've been to Aswan last year. This year we're talking about returning to Luxor. We also are interested in the Middle East and have done some cruises that have taken us through routes there, and we'd like to do another one of those. So I think currently those are our favorites.
Okay. So speaking of Egypt, is that a safe place to travel at the moment? Because a couple of years ago, a lot of package companies withdrew from Egypt.
Well, I guess I couldn't say carte blanche that any place is safe. We have never experienced any fear factor in traveling. There's never been any place we've walked or felt threatened. I do know that on our flight from Athens last year, we had additional security, and we didn't realize it was the day of the bombing of the church in Egypt. Right. And it turned out the head of the church was on our flight. He was returning from his vacation in Athens. So that was a little bit disconcerting, I guess, with bomb-sniffing dogs going through the plane. But even that said, we had a perfectly fine flight. Didn't know about the bombing until we got to Cairo and saw it on CNN. So, we have felt safe there. I know there are people who are not comfortable yet going there, and they need to judge that by their own comfort level.
Of course. So, is there any place you've been to that you thought, I'm never going back there?
Oh, I think there have been some that maybe we haven't liked as well as others, but I think everything deserves a second chance. We were laughing. We did not heed the advice of our fellow residents here and chose to go to the Greek islands in August. They were crowded with tourists. The ferries were crowded. The lines were long. And if it was my first impression of Greece, I'd probably think, oh, do I really want to go back? But I knew better. We knew better.
Yeah.
It was a great experience to see it. And so that might be my kind of least favorite time to travel now.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any destination that we've come across that we'd never go back to.
Okay.
When you were writing as a journalist, you would write articles, I presume, and stories. How does blogging differ from that kind of writing? I mean, are the articles shorter or?
Yes, they are shorter. I guess to do a comparison, I did a lot of freelance writing for the Seattle Times. And when I first started doing travel articles there, I believe the stories could go up to maybe 1,800 words. And then as space constraints got more and more, the story in the sidebar and any information maybe was 1,200 words. And a blog, to be kind of a successfully read blog, shouldn't be any more than 800 words, about 600 to 800. You better be able to tell your story or you're going to lose your reader. Mm. They'll start scrolling down to look at the pictures. But it is good because it keeps you sharp. If you really are trying to be a blogger that somebody wants to read, you do have to analyze your words. It's as though you're writing for an editor again, and you know the editor's going to slash those words, so you have to slash your own words. So,
yeah. So your experience as a journalist obviously has given you a bit of a head start in knowing how to write.
Definitely. I think, and it's unfortunate that blogs aren't seen as a real bona fide source of information in a lot of people's minds. However, there are some very fine journalists that are writing blogs, and as we've talked earlier, making money from the blogging.
Yeah.
And they are a source of information. Mm-hmm. So if people are going to turn to them for a source of information, you've got to give them a product that's worth reading and not begin. We had a wonderful time and went out to dinner on our first night that we were on our trip after we picked up grandma and the grandkids and the da-da-da. You've got to tell a story as though you're writing for an audience.
Yeah, that's good advice.
It is good advice. And how much time do you spend writing each week?
In the summer, probably less because people are busy and we know that readership drops tremendously. They've got their own lives to lead. So I usually do one blog a week in the summer, and I would say I might spend 4 to 6 hours on it by the time I do the research, because I do go back and research places and things to get the exact information and not just my observations on where I've been. So
So while you're traveling, you're keeping notes and taking pictures.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I have stacks of travel journals and notes.
And sit down and make an article.
And sales receipts with things written on the back. I just can't forget.
I suppose your notebook becomes ever more important in that environment.
Yes, it does. And just taking notes on the who, what, when, where, why.
Yeah. People. And is it important to be a good photographer as well?
I think so. I think you need to be able to catch a reader, and not every reader is going to start out with a 6-paragraph opening. They're going to want to see that picture of some pretty beach or some Sphinx or some, cruise ship. Mm-hmm. And then maybe that will catch their eye and they want to know more about it.
How many followers do you have for your blog?
I have under 100 followers. I have, several hundred subscribers, and that by subscribers it means you fill in your name and mm-hmm. and it comes in on the email. It doesn't mean people pay money to subscribe. Mm-hmm. Actually, my best source of readership is Facebook. By posting blog posts onto the Facebook, I have a Travel and Write Facebook page as well as mine, and I find that oftentimes hundreds will see the post there versus that's my source
yeah.
versus doing a Google search. Mm-hmm. Although I have been contacted by readers that said, I think my most recent one of interest was researching springtime in the Peloponnese, and my blog came up. So she began reading my blog because of something I had written from the springtime in the Peloponnese. So labels that you put on the blog post can mm-hmm. make or break you. I tell people about it. I don't go out and force people to read the blog. Here's my card. Blog. This is my life. This is my story. No, I would say that probably the social media and word of mouth is how I do it.
Mm. And obviously you've got readers going onto your Facebook page, and you said that some of them contact you. Do you kind of get comments left and discussion started and debate and lots of feedback?
That's probably the best part of a blog versus a freelance article, is the fact that people can comment and ask questions, leave comments, and you find that once you've been in the blogosphere, as we call it, that you start having a group of friends and fellow writers and readers that you would have never met otherwise that will comment, and you do start knowing people's lives, and it does open the door to meeting people when you travel. I know when we were in Australia, I called one of my fellow bloggers and struck up a conversation. Another one who lived in South Korea contacted me when she came through the States and we got together. So it does start opening a world of relationships that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
It's interesting, isn't it? As with the podcast, you start to build a community.
You do, exactly.
And that's a lovely experience.
People start waiting for that. It's like, we've wondered where you were, wanted to know, or they'll leave the comment and say, well, hurry up, I want to know what's happening next week. So that's always encouraging when someone says, okay, I'm ready, let's do whatever you're doing next week.
And if I was starting up a blog on, say, cooking, what top tips would you have for me as a starting out as a blogger?
Set aside a number of hours, because there's the hours that you spend writing your blog, but to have a successful blog, you've got to be interactive with other bloggers and in the blogosphere. You've got to be linking to blog link ups, so you're participating in group promotions. I guess that would be a form of promotion where you put your blog out. And in doing so, you need to read other people's blogs. A number of them have a requirement that if you link here, you will need to read and comment on 5 blogs. And so, but that's good, because then you do expand your horizons, but it does take time. You know, you're reading, you're writing, you're commenting, you're responding to comments if someone has an answer. Plus, you would also, in the case of cooking, I suppose you'd need to be going out trying the food.
Of course.
Finding the good recipes and those kind of things. So the research and the writing and the interacting with others and things, it takes time, but it's fun.
Yeah. But if it's something that you're involved in any case.
Right.
It's a way of taking your writing with you and letting
it
meld with your real life.
It is. And it's a way of bringing friends in to enjoy your cooking in that case. It would be fun to have them do that.
So what have you learned that you wish you'd known before you started?
Oh, I think the time commitment is one thing. The other thing, and it's very humbling for any writer, is to know that you started so you would keep your friends and family informed of what you were doing, and to learn that your friends and family are the ones least likely to read what you've written. That it's the world out there that's going to be reading. And I had a fellow here in this area who wrote, and it came up and said, well, and there was a lady, too, that lives here, I came up to introduce myself to her and said, I know who you are. You're Jackie Smith, and you're going to Cairo next month. And I said, how did you know that? She said, well, I read your blog. So it's the strangers out there, the people that you haven't met that will be reading your blog. Mm-hmm. And so I've quit writing for my family and friends. Mm-hmm. I now write for my audience, who is a world of unknowns. I don't write with references to the Pacific Northwest anymore unless I explain how that ties into what I'm writing about, because my readers are going to be in United Kingdom or Australia. They're not going to be my friends sitting back in the Pacific Northwest. No. So I think what I've learned is that I need to think globally. I don't need to think of family and friends, but think globally of that unknown reader, the same one that's reading a story that you've written or reading an article that you've written, that you're writing for multitudes that you may never know that you've written for.
Yeah. So. Wow.
Brilliant.
That's excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks.
It's been really
lovely
helpful.
Talking to you. Lovely to meet you.
Well, nice meeting you.
Good.
Excellent.
Thank you.
That was interesting. I must admit, I haven't read any of those, but I'm moved to read.
I thought it was very interesting when she said how humbling it was to realise that your friends and family are not interested in your writing.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually you're writing for the multitudes out there, and I suppose, I suppose that's how it goes.
Yeah.
I'm very fortunate some of my friends and family are interested in my writing.
None of mine are. I can tell you, I've been blogging since 2008. Actually, my first blog was me archiving a series of text-only newsletters. I was sending out an email newsletter, but I was archiving it on my site. And so my little five-page website grew to have, well, I was doing one a week, so it had 52 articles on the back end, and Google could get it. And that's how I got all my traffic in the early days. But blogging software was only invented in 2006.
So
friends and family totally ignore everything I do online, although I have made many friends from people who've
got in
contact.
Was another interesting point that they both, Monica and Jackie, were talking about the community that they were now part of, and the friends that they made.
That's Wilf.
That was Wilf.
Wilf shaking himself. The friends that they've made. But the one thing that struck me about both of them is they're both writers first.
Absolutely.
Right.
So this is not something you get into because you want to be a blogger. You need to know how to write
in order
to do it. Otherwise, as Nicola was saying, when people are putting a load of rubbish out there, you know, it's just like self-publishing a book that hasn't got been spell checked.
There's a whole raft of things, isn't there? Both of them are writers and good writers. They also are good photographers, as was mentioned. There's also the whole thing about setting up the blog, and we talked to Alison Robertson last week, didn't we? And she spent hours and hours, not on the writing and the photographs, but just making the blog look right as well. And then there's the business side of it, not so important to Jackie, because her blog is not her livelihood.
Her blog is her portfolio, isn't
it? Exactly. Yeah, and they both said that's how they started. It's very interesting.
I didn't know there was special blog software.
WordPress that we all use now is in the early days it was Typepress. They set up this thing that if you didn't know how to write HTML code, which I do, I taught myself, how to do it in, 1995. But, and I loved it. I loved the fact you could write gobbledygook and it turned into pictures. As a visual person, I found that very exciting. But then the first blog software was the Typepress.
There's quite a lot now, Squarespace, Typepress,
but
WordPress.
It's for people who don't want to do the coding, basically. Point and click.
And most people don't. I mean, I've got a blog, but I've used Wix actually.
Yeah.
For mine.
I subscribed to a couple of friends' blogs, and that's on WordPress.
That was interesting. That she said that she's got a lot more subscribers than she has
followers.
Which is great. And that's another thing that the blog software did, was it enabled people to click a little button and get notified by email every time you put a new blog post up. And that helped people grow quite fast.
And also the cross-platform thing that Jackie mentioned, that Facebook is generating viewers and readers for her blog. And you've got to be on, if you're going to do it, and I'm not, you've got to be across all these things and on top of it all.
Well, that's where you have to talk to somebody like Monica on her e-course, or Nicola on her
Social media.
Right. Because it is a lot more complicated than I actually thought, you know, listening to the two interviews and just chatting about it. I suppose naively thought it was really quite simple. You sat at the computer and, you know, you wrote a few things and that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, as we had a conversation with Alison, our competition winner, I was able to give her five simple tips to improve the reach of her blog posts, which, you know, if you know how to do that, then it helps Google to know what your blog's about. Mm-hmm. And you know, things about blogging, you know, if you're writing naturally, you're going to be using what's called latent semantic indexing, which is when you use a word, say, for example, you're writing about travel, you would then talk about trains and cars and coaches and checking in. And those are all words that Google associates with the core topic. Uh-huh. So, and that happens quite naturally when you're writing naturally. And so Google is very intelligent. It does know when you're writing about something that is natural. Mm. As a human would speak.
Google, knowing all this.
Well, if it ain't there, it's Facebook knowing, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, we've just about used up our time for this week. But before we go, we're going to have Teresa and Naomi Kruger tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Teresa, what's on your bedside table?
I'm reading The Poison Bed by E.C. Fremantle. And this is based on a true historical event in England in the reign of James I. There was a murder, perhaps. I mean, some theories say maybe he wasn't poisoned, maybe he died of natural causes, but we're calling it the murder of Thomas Overbury. And suspicion fell on the celebrated couple, Robert and Frances Carr. She has been rescued from an abusive marriage and is determined to make a new life for herself, whatever the price. He has risen from nothing to become one of the country's most powerful men. But to get to the top, he couldn't help making enemies on the way. Mm. So that's the basic setup. And what E.C. Fremantle has done, she alternates chapters from the viewpoints of Frances and Robert, which is quite an interesting technique, and it's quite effective. She is talking from the Tower of London in retrospect, looking back, whereas looking back on their relationship and how they got to this stage, whereas he is sort of in the present moment moving forward. It's very well done. One of the things that a historical novelist, I think, has to do when they're dealing with real life people is they have to make choices which may not always be popular. So she's had to make a decision of whether James I had a physical relationship with Robert Carr. Mm-hmm. And some people would say, you know, that he was bisexual, the king. Others would say it was just the fashion of the day that men talked in these loving ways to each other. But as a novelist, you've just got to choose. It's extremely well done. It's a very interesting case, and I haven't got to the end of it yet, but it's good.
Yeah. So now let's hear what Naomi has on her bedside table.
My name's Naomi Kruger, and I'm going to talk about a book that I'm reading called Someone at a Distance by Dorothy Whipple. And this was published in 1953 originally. I came across it through a company called Persephone Books, who focus on publishing books that have gone out of print, but they think, especially by women authors, and they think they deserve to have another chance, you know, and to be known. And really, it's quite a simple story. It follows Avery, who's a publisher in London, and his wife, Ellen, who's kind of the picture of domestic bliss, and she runs their home in a leafy suburb, and they have two children. So they have this sort of rural idyll, and into this, you know that something's going to go wrong, I think. Into this comes a sort of exotic, disappointed, beautiful French woman called Louise, who is a companion to Avery's mother. And so it's quite a predictable story in some ways. You know that their family is going to be disrupted by this woman, and it is. But what I loved about this book is the subtlety of the writing. All the characters have a fully fledged, you know, nuanced, layered life. And the way that Dorothy Whipple writes about domesticity and sort of ordinary things and happiness as well is just really beautifully done. So even though you sort of know what's going to happen, the hero of the story becomes Ellen, who's the wife who has to kind of re-put her life together after the way that her life, she thought her life would go is completely disrupted. And it's really quite moving. But what I also loved about it is that although Louise could easily be the villain of the piece, and certainly she's not someone you'd want as a best friend, I don't think, even her motivations are entirely clear. You understand, even though you want her to make different choices, why she does what she does and what motivates her. So I was really kind of blown away by this book in how subtle it is, how it accumulates and all the layers of the characters come together. And by the end of it, I just felt completely immersed in this world. And for me, what I love about fiction, reading and writing it, is imagining what it might be like to be somebody else. And what this book does is really, in a really rounded and beautiful way, just gives you that kind of window into another life. And because it's set in a different time as well, I think that I found that really interesting. So yeah, I'd highly recommend it. And it felt like a discovery as well, because she's a sort of forgotten voice that's been brought back to life again.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed today's podcast and that you're going to join us again next week. Until then, we'd love to hear from you. Give some feedback. Go over to our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast. And drop us a line. We'd love to hear what you think. In the meantime, you can also subscribe. Not in the meantime. We also would like to have you subscribe to iTunes or We'd also like to have you subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it, and it's all free. So tell a friend about Write Club. Help us grow our audience, and we're going to see you next week.
Bye!